Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Okay, so it's a party.
Yes.
But about TV.
Yes. Join us every Monday for TV Party, where we'll talk about the news of the moment, the best episodes of the week, and what we can't wait to find sitting on our DVRs.
We'll also chat with actors, writers, and experts about TV, elect classic characters to our Hall of Faces, deep dive into full seasons of some great shows, and more.
Find us at Consequence of Sound, iTunes, or wherever you procure fine podcasts.
Oh, Clint, one more thing. Is it open bar?
It's BYO.
Got it.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to this week's episode of This Must Be The Gig. I'm your host, Leo Phillips. Welcome back. And for all the podcast people out there, if you're just tuning in for the first time, this show is really your backstage pass to the world of live music. I want to show you the ins and the outs of the process, and I'm going to do that through interviews with legendary artists and amazing set designers and choreographers. And after this episode, please make sure to go back a few weeks and just binge, like you do your Netflix, just podcast binge, the countless stories about the one gig that has changed people's lives. I've got from David Byrne to Shirley Manson of Garbage and many more amazing artists, and really just find out which song it was and which venue it happened at, all the thrilling details. Make sure to tell me about your life-changing moment as well on Instagram or Facebook at TMBTGpod. And I don't have my sidekick here, engineer, producer, Adam, but I can still say at TMBTGpod. It's not the same. It's not the same. But don't forget to write it up in a 5-star review on iTunes, on Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. This week, I'm reporting to you live from the ridiculously delightful and very sunshiny Portugal. I'm recording in my very own Portuguese palace, hotel room. I'm in Lisbon, and I'm going to keep this extra short, like a little Portuguese midday nap, as I'm rushing out the door to get to Nossa Live Festival, which I'm covering. But I've been here taking in the sights and the sounds, the local scene, and I've eaten the entire ocean of fish. Give me all your fish, Portugal. I also experienced plenty of breathtaking moments, and I've got such an incredible interview to share with you this episode. I was lucky enough to sit down with the brilliant Lauren, Ian, and Martin of Churches a few hours before their performance in Lisbon. And I finally got to hear the new album Love Is Dead live. And boy, yo, the love I have for those songs ain't dead. You know, we chat about so much, about the build-up to that record, how to keep yourself really entertained in festival green rooms, and so much more. This is me, Ian, Lauren, and Martin, live from Portugal. Enjoy! Obrigada! Bye! Let's actually introduce yourselves so that our listeners can know who's talking.
Yes, my name is Lauren.
I'm Martin.
And I'm Ian.
Thanks. So wait, you said you got here last night. Do you usually have like a day before your festivals? Do you usually have something to, you know, a little bit of a break?
Not usually, no. It's just that the show tonight is at like 2:45 in the morning or something, so that's kind of late.
Yeah, we kind of got an accidental day off, which was nice because it seems nice here.
Yeah.
And we've been playing a lot of festivals, so it's nice to, like, I had a shower that was plugged into the ground today. Like, it was in a building, and, like, so that's really rare at this point in the summer, so.
I think it's, yeah, good to mention how beautiful this hotel is, so it's
very
kind
fancy,
of...
yeah.
I didn't know how to work the curtains.
Why,
the curtains
automatic?
Are some, like, weird mechanism. I've never seen it before. I figured it out eventually.
Pulled on mine.
Well, turns out that's what it's supposed to. I don't know.
I just like pulled them shut. So
basically, you've broken the curtain.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's like a thing at the side that you're supposed to use. It's like a pulley thing. I don't know.
How often do you play shows that are that late? Is that a silly question to ask? I suppose because it really is quite late in the day to be playing. You obviously can't choose when you're playing, but how do you manage to stay awake? I think that's my question.
I think it's kind of common in Spain and Portugal for festivals to run this
late.
I think it's highly unusual everywhere else in the world. We were on late at Primavera.
Yeah.
Really late.
And I guess it must be informed by the same way as like some shops and stuff shut in the afternoon. Is that, I think that's because of the heat.
Well, they have like a siesta. Yeah, they have like a nap.
So I guess if your festival's not starting till like 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Then it makes sense to finish at 4. I believe we're playing till 4 a.m. today.
Wow.
The sun will be like fully coming up.
I like that big audible sigh. That's great. I'm sorry.
Thing.
Yeah, thank you.
But I think it'll be good. And it's been a lot. We've had a really good festival experience here before a few years ago. So hopefully it'll be similar. And I kind of feel like the tiredness, as soon as it's like time for the show, you don't feel tired anymore. It's like the sitting around beforehand, making conversation, napping on the floor, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, we're very lucky. It's a good job to have, I would say.
I remember it being like a kind of arcade game of crowd surfers. Yeah. Like security versus the crowd surfers the last time we played here.
Where
and
did
it
you
was
play?
Like a stream of people coming down this natural amphitheater.
It was the Paradise de Cura festival. And it was kind of on a bit of a slope, so I feel like if people started crowd surfing further back, they just gained so much momentum.
Yeah.
They were like crushing wee lassies at the front, which wasn't, I didn't like that much. But I appreciate their enthusiasm. I'm like, just don't, you know,
thanks for being
one person's gig experience is not more important than another. You're all in it together. Everyone just cooperate, you know.
Well,
you
some of them got their comeuppance on the night.
Yeah.
Literally. Do you ever like have to stop a show if you see people getting like kind of squished in the front row? Because I've obviously seen you play all over the world and I've covered you everywhere and people are nuts for you. And even me, like in the pit taking photos, I get squished even by the other photographers because they like have to get their shot, you know? So do you ever stop and say something? Has that ever happened?
Very, very rarely. I think people are generally pretty good.
I think we're pretty lucky. Like, generally, we have a really, like, cool, respectful, thoughtful fan base. Like, once every so often, something will happen. And then I do kind of feel like it's your job. Because we see stuff that security might not see.
Might not see, exactly.
So
you have this, like, vantage point.
I guess, and I don't know. I know other people have different opinions on it, but I kind of feel like my job is to sing the songs and stuff, but it's also to kind of run the show to an extent. And if you see something happening, if somebody is intent on creating a circle pit, then they will continue to do that. And then if I specifically tell them not to, they're not going to enjoy that anyway. But it's more about kind of alerting security to it, because, you know, sometimes I am a tiny person at shows.
And sometimes
I'm like, I'm totally down for everyone having a good time, whatever way they want, but, you know, just gotta make sure that people don't get bloody noses. And
yeah.
It's not, and you know, drowning pool. It's churches.
There's never been a circle pit at a church's show for
no,
that matter.
No, when people are starting fights and stuff, then I stop when there's fights.
I've seen a few bros, like, fighting each
have
other.
Have you?
Aye, but once, like...
But wait, before...
You're talking about once every 300 gigs here. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. But I suppose everybody, you know, every artist that I've spoken to is completely different. They either see it as their responsibility to say something, or they're like, fuck that, I'm just here to do my show, and then they leave, which is strange.
Yeah, it seems... I mean, it does seem odd to turn a blind eye to stuff that you can see going on, I suppose, especially if people are actually in danger, you know. It's one thing if people are just having fun and enjoying themselves, but that's a very different conversation.
Yeah.
It happens so rarely for us, like it's not really like we have to have a policy on it, but I kind of feel like when it does happen, the innocent person in that situation came to the show to see your band, you know?
Totally.
Like, and I feel like that's why it makes it your problem. So it's easy for someone to be like, well, it's not for me to just talk about it. I'm just playing the show. I'm like, yeah, but at the end of the day, that person bought a ticket and came down here and took
just like you did. Absolutely.
And if you don't do anything about it, what's within your power to do something about it, then even if it's just to, like, flag it so then the security guys are watching that
can
area,
do something.
You know, because otherwise they leave feeling, like, sad about the experience that they had at your show. So,
it's true. And then the one fan's like, oh, I got crushed at a church's show. It's like, no, it's horrible. But some terrible things, I know that you can make light of it, but terrible things can happen at shows, especially for women. Like, I know working at these shows, the amount of, like, men I've had to, like, you know, be so aggressive toward, and also seeing like people just fighting because, you know, you get drunk at festivals and there's so much stuff that happens. Did you guys start out as fans going to festivals or going to just one-off concerts from where you're from? Obviously everybody will be different, but how did your experience of seeing live music start?
It started before, younger than when I was old enough to go to festivals. So, but eventually I did. Yeah, I guess, I think I was 14 in my first show. And then, you know, later on, as you get a little bit older, you tend to gravitate towards festivals because they provide good value for money.
Yeah.
And you can get away from your mum and dad and you can get like, pissed all weekend and all that. But I don't know. Like, I guess when you live
show?
In Glasgow, there's a lot of bands come through anyway, so you tend to see most of what you want to see.
Mm.
First show was Oasis.
No way, at 14?
Yeah.
Did your parents know that you were going?
Yeah, I won tickets on the radio station. At the radio station. Yeah.
That is amazing.
But there was a riot at that gig and they walked off stage after like 40 minutes. That's Glasgow.
Yeah. So Oasis walked off stage?
Yeah, someone hit Liam Gallagher with a bottle, if I remember rightly.
Wow. Well, I mean, he is a bit of a drama queen.
Why were there bottles in the venue?
Because people sneak alcohol into gigs, Oasis gigs especially. Yeah.
Like, what were they doing?
Are you making an admission now?
I don't think I had booze, no. But I was sitting really far away in the seats. And my enduring memory is like all the people being really upset when they wouldn't come back on and then ripping the seats out of the thing at the SCCC.
Was he hurt?
No, he was fine.
Oh, I think he was like lobbed in the face with like a glass bottle, and I was like, I would stop playing if someone hit me in the face with a glass bottle.
I don't know what type of bottle it was. I think it was more of a, I'm like the king of this gig, and now that you've insulted me, I'm not coming back on situation.
I feel like this story could be relevant.
People got really
now.
Upset.
You'd probably do that now. So it's, you know.
Yeah.
Did you all grow up in Glasgow?
I guess I grew up kind of outside Stirling, which is kind of slightly more central, and Ian was on the other coast.
I was pretty central as well.
Yeah.
West Lothian, right in between Edinburgh and Glasgow. So about the same as Stirling, but a bit south.
So did you have to travel to go to shows? Because obviously you were a little bit outside of the cities.
Yeah, I mean, the first show I went to was The Cult at Livingston Forum, which is actually really close to where I grew up.
Yeah.
But I can account that, and the same week Aerosmith played, and I was in the front row for that, and I didn't expect that I was going to be crushed to death, but I pretty much was.
I mean, it's Aerosmith, man. They get crazy. Yeah,
that was my first two gigs, and they happened in the same week, which was kind of mind-blowing.
Did you go with your family or with your mates?
No, I went with my mates. Yeah, I remember my mate's mum got us tickets and we ended up going.
I love that you can say, how old were you? Were you also...
15.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So super
no
young. Yeah. Are you just saying that because we're live? Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay. And you, Lauren, what was your first show, or at least most memorable, I suppose? Those are two different things, so maybe your first show.
Well, I guess my entry was probably a bit different because I was like a preteen girl that liked boy bands because that's what you're told to like. So I went to see a band called Boyzone. I don't know if
loved
they're...
Boyzone.
Went to see...
So I'm from South Africa, so we got everything.
You got Boyzone too, because
when
you talk to American journalists, they're like,
they do not know.
Because they had their own... They had like the kind of... Top tier boy bands,
and then
I was very into NSYNC.
So was I.
I was pretty into the Backstreet Boys, but I was very into NSYNC, and I was into Boyzone.
What's the other one?
98 Degrees.
Thank you. I was 99 cents.
Mm-hmm. No, 98 specifically. That kind of stuff, and then there was like the Smash Hits Magazine tour. So there was like just a bunch of those kind of pop bands on one tour. After that, it was like Green Day and the American Idiot tour. I think the first like non-pop show I went to was Jimmy Eat World, and maybe that's why I have I'm conscious of crowd surfing, because I got there super early. I was at the doors and I was like going to be like a few rows from the front, and then it was like first song wiped out by a crowd surfer. I had to get pulled out, and I had to get like tended to by the first aid and stuff. And so I think when I see those things, I'm like, I know how badly this is gonna go for you. So yes,
it looks very dangerous.
Well, but people must get something exhilarating out of it. I don't know.
You know those ones that like stand, I don't know if you've ever seen, I'm like calling them those ones, like lumping them together, but those guys that like stand, but then they turn their backs and they like fall back into the crowd. Have you seen those?
My favorite ones are ones that have got backpacks. I'm like, don't.
And have like machinery on.
Yes, I'm like, why? I guess that's where you're carrying your stuff, you know? They're all
day. Where would they, to think about it, where would they leave their backpack if they came to crowd?
So I respect their commitment.
It's a great way to get out of a spot, though.
Yeah, rather than being like, excuse me, trying to get out.
The new thing I see at shows is the human tower.
The human
where, like,
tower.
Everyone, like, they try and get like three stacks of people on each other's shoulders.
Like a totem pole.
Yeah, like that's a totem pole. That's totally a thing. I see it actually all the time now. And the other one is people trying to literally stand on each other's shoulders.
Yeah.
You ever seen that?
Like a trapeze artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That takes some skill, by the way. That's like that. There's something in that.
But everybody always looks so happy when they're doing all these things. Like the amount of stuff. I mean, you've obviously toured and gone to much more shows than I have probably covered. But, you know, I was actually looking at all the different places that you've been, because I was trying to like map when I first saw you and covered you. I think it was like Roskilde when I first got to shoot you.
Mm.
That was like,
it's a cool festival.
I think it was 2 years ago. But you guys have toured so much over the past few years. Does it feel like you've been able to see the world, or do you feel like it is absolutely part of your job and it hasn't really, you know, it's just something that you're doing, it's part of you? Or do you feel like you've been able to actually travel and see places that you visited?
I think a little of both, probably. Yeah, I think sometimes people have the misconception that you have a day off in every single place.
I know,
and you go
so much time.
But that's just not practical. You know, but sometimes you definitely do get evenings off and maybe the odd day somewhere, and I think you just need to figure out the balance. You're like, for your health, do you need to like chill out today, or should you take advantage of this and go see things? And I feel like, yeah, we're really lucky to have got to, I don't know, I never was in a band that could get any shows outside the UK, let alone anything else. So I feel like it's been really fortuitous.
I think that it's strange, I suppose, when you firstly get asked that weird question, but I think for me, I'm really curious about it, because every single person, no matter if they're a musician or just a general artist, how they handle the time, it's that sweet spot between your performance and being like a normal human being. I think there's a huge misconception about what you're actually doing with that time. I once like spoke to Ozzy Osbourne, who's like really lovely and sweet, and he was like, the worst moment is the waiting for him to go on stage because he's so bored, which is why he obviously turned to drugs and all the, you know, all the things in his life. It's such a difficult space between, you know, deciding like, right, do I actually like put effort into living or, you know,
and
put it all into performing?
One of the big problems as well is it's the difference between all those hours of boredom in that one or two hours of intensity and adrenaline.
And how that's
and you're extremely
so
high if it's a great show. And then, you know, and then you come down again. And I think that managing between those kind of peaks is a really difficult thing to do. Mm.
Just watch a lot of TV.
Do you? I wanted to ask you what you do because there's so many things that you could do to buy time. And also you mentioned like keep your health in check and keep your brain stimulated that you don't just go crazy. What do you watch?
Nights like this is fine. You can go to the gym, you can watch TV. You can do all sorts of normal stuff like you're just hanging out in your house. It's a little bit hard. Harder if you're in like a festival dressing room where it's just like a little box where you sit for five hours or something, but it's not like I'm down a mine, you know. It's fine. It's not a bad job, just playing Nintendo and watch Netflix for a bit. Bit of glow, I like a bit of glow right now.
I just started Glamorous Ladies of Wrestling.
That's brilliant.
But yeah, I think, I don't know, it's like learning about yourself and learning about each other. Like I think I definitely do different things to fill the downtime now than I did when we started the band.
Really?
Just more, like, positive. I think I used to just fill it with more work, like, self-created tasks, kind of. And now I feel like it's important to have a balance between, like, you know, doing, like, a bit of exercise or, like, a little bit of work or a little bit of glow or whatever.
Yeah, because you can't be on it all the time.
Yeah, I think it's about kind of trying to... I don't know, maybe it's an age thing, like, not that I am aged, but, like, get, you know, being a little bit older and be like, okay, like, check in with yourself. Mm. What do you actually need? Because I think that a lot of musicians don't think about that as much as maybe is good to, because, you know, physically you could be okay or mentally, but if you're not feeling great on either of those fronts, then the show is not good. So ultimately, at the end of the day, it's for your benefit, but it's for the benefit of the tour.
Yeah. So. I think that it's, I know that you probably feel like you've maybe said this before or other people have said this, but I think that it's really important to say that. And I really appreciate you saying that because people are so often like, whoa, let's party. And I had the most amazing chat with Wyoke about it. I don't know if you know, Jen and Andy are like, Jen was saying how she obviously hates touring and she is so conscious of that time and she doesn't want to work so hard in between the moments because she's like, I really need to break. Mm. So it's really interesting that you said that changed over time. You know, as you do get older and more experienced and realize that you need to have a little bit more self-care.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And just figuring out, I think I used to use work to fill... because I think in some ways I'm quite like organizing something makes me feel a little bit better because it's like you're controlling some things you can control in a job where you don't really get to control very much. But I think sometimes I could take it too far and I'm like, I would just be working on something at some point all day and I'm like, okay, that's not good because you need to at some point switch your brain off. Like, I think that's the trouble with touring. Sometimes your brain is so switched off because you're not doing anything creative and you're not doing anything intelligent, really. Not that playing's not intelligent, but you're not really using
in the downtime.
Yeah. Right. But then on the other side, you don't want to be constantly working because then you're not... I don't know. I feel like it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle is a healthy balance. Audiobooks. Just discovered audiobooks. Never really... I haven't listened to an audiobook since I was like 10.
Yeah. It's like a road trip thing. It's a big thing now, though, especially with just like... I can imagine if you're traveling all the time, you can't be carrying around mounds of books, although... It's lovely to have.
Kindle.
Yeah, or Kindle.
Well, yeah. And I was so reluctant to do that because I was like, no, I don't. I want to read real books and hold them and lend them to people afterwards and stuff. But it's much easier to have now. And then when we talk about a book, I can get it.
Yeah, you can just get it right there.
That's it. So.
But and also traveling together, do you... This might sound like a strange question, but I suppose I'm wondering, do you... get to check in with each other, seeing as though you've played with each other for so long and toured all over the world together. I don't know. Do you spend all the time together?
Spend time trying to get away from each other.
I mean, you're sitting in the middle. Like I like your position. You're really
hours
trying
a day
to get
together.
Away. Yeah, right.
No, it's you know, by default, spend an exceptionally large amount of time together. It's just... part of the gig. It's like a family. You spend more time with your bandmates than you do with your family. And that's one of the great things about it because you forge amazing friendships, but it's an unusual state of affairs. Everyone needs their own downtime as well. And you can find that. You find it. It's kind of the unwritten rule of, like, don't talk to me is when someone just puts their headphones on.
Yes.
That just says, like, I just need a minute. And that's fine. Because... keeping your mind right on tour is the hardest thing of all to do. And you need your friends around you. And luckily, yeah, you have them all the time. But sometimes you just need to be alone too. And that can be difficult. It's much easier now that we've managed to get to a level where we can tour comfortably. But
right.
In the beginning of touring, before this band, it's like you're in a van and it's on. That's it.
Ian has his hands over his
face. That's it. You're in a van, and America is a big country.
Oh, my God. You know, you've toured more in America, I think, than you've toured anywhere else, right?
Our band?
I think.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
I just moved to Chicago a year ago.
Oh.
How do you find... Chicago's really lovely. It's
good.
Easy to acclimate into a place like that as opposed to a New York or an L.A., especially... I lived in Israel for the last 4 years, so I went from South Africa to Middle East to American culture, which is very strange.
Very different.
Yeah, especially as a journalist, because I was covering, obviously, a lot of the Palestinian issues on the ground, and then you get to America and you're like, nope, don't want to touch this stuff.
Yes. I've noticed, I was spending time in the States, like, that's a different conversation there than it is in the UK. Like, there's definitely... elements of that in the UK, but it's definitely a completely different conversation in the States than what we are used to, I suppose.
Yeah.
So but you're probably equipped to handle that discussion in a way that we are not.
Do you know how contentious South African government is and Israeli government? It's like, I've had enough shit.
You wanted
a
rest.
Life.
You wanted a rest, so you moved to Obama era America, and then look what you got handed.
Obama's from Chicago. It's dire there, by the way. I'm sure that a lot of the elements of what you also write about, and especially the title of your latest album, there are elements of that where you aren't oblivious to the political state of the world.
I was reading just before I came downstairs about Trump's visit to the UK. And I'll say, bleak, very bleak.
Why is he even going? I don't understand. He's not wanted.
I'm not really sure. The inflatable baby is apparently making its way to Scotland for his visit to Turnberry. So, yes, good Scottish police apparently pushed the permit through so the baby was allowed to travel. So, inflatable baby will travel. but Nicola Sturgeon's going to be at the Pride Parade in Glasgow instead of meeting Trump, which... good for her.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Do you feel like there is no separation between being an artist and having an opinion about the political state, considering how it affects everyone? Like, it's not just the shit that's happening in America or the stuff that's happening in Spain or all these different things. Do you feel, not necessarily a responsibility as such, but that the connection isn't... You don't have a disconnect, that it's just... you as a person can comment on political things.
I don't know. I think it's odd when people talk about, you shouldn't talk about that. You should separate those things. Why is that for you to talk about? Because what do they think songs are written about? Songs are written about thoughts and feelings and how people see the world. So I think there's a difference between deliberately shoehorning politics into a song and making it clunky, and it's not actually connecting with anybody. It's not honest in that way. But it's also equally... unnatural to remove things on purpose. And I think that's kind of what got us into a little bit of this problem in the first place, is people not caring about things that they personally don't feel like they need to care about. And, I don't know, I don't think that the two things have to... that's what's odd when people talk to us about stuff. It's so strange to me, because people are a couple of months after the first album came out, people were like, "Oh, well, you're a political band."
And I know.
We aren't even actually at this point saying anything political.
No.
We had just said these are, laid out some pretty common sense concepts, not things that were new or anything. So in that instance, I was like, if that's all it takes for you to be dubbed political, then fine. I'd rather be that than be on the other team. But it just kind of, I think it speaks more to the apathy and privilege of other people in the position than the fact that we were trying to be Rage Against the Machine or something.
Yeah, of course. And I say this with a lot of love, there is a lot that you have to deal with in general as a band, especially Can you imagine a 19-year-old coming into this industry and being asked about the political state and not knowing what the fuck, where they stand, you know, not know, maybe their family's right wing. You never know the, you know, the politics of their own family. So it's really hard sometimes, I think, as a any sort of press or media to expect that of a band. But I also think from the other side of it, if you don't say anything in this state, there has to be something wrong, you know, because you have to speak for, you have a platform, I suppose. So it's a balance. I don't know if you, you agree.
Plus, I think something I think is really important is allowing people the space and capacity to grow and change. Like, I don't think the same things now as I thought when I was 18. So I think that I have much more respect for somebody saying, actually, I've gone out and I've met people and I've thought about these things and I've changed my opinion.
Yeah.
But I would say that the media should take responsibility for some of the things that they do, because the conversation that we have with the media now is very different than it was 6 years ago. And that's not because suddenly, no offence, everybody in the media grew a conscience and started figuring out maybe she wasn't being a prick this
You've
whole
been
time.
Saying
like they
stuff for a long
have
time.
Only
I know.
Really changed. A lot of the people in the kind of cool alternative press have only really changed the way that they're talking to us or about us because stuff changed around them, the landscape changed, so they had to change, otherwise they would look really jarring.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's interesting. Like, that, they're totally, I'm glad that those opinions are changing, but it's hard to know whether those things are actually changing
Real.
Or you're just saying that because it's the current narrative. And
exactly.
It's those people come in with the same level of confidence that they are right in the situation, but their opinion is completely different, and they haven't addressed that. And I find that interesting, because it's still like, no offense, oftentimes a dude telling me, oh, so this is the problem with, this is what's going on with feminism, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, aha. Whereas like 5 years
that,
ago,
yeah.
It was most of, no offense, most of the time male journalists being like, so explain to me, why do this?
Yeah.
And you're like, ugh. But I do think...
You get a lot of shit, progress. Though, I'm not going to lie. But it's because you have men interviewing you and or people who are not maybe worldly. I mean, not to say, like, men... I'm not a gender...
Hashtag not all men. But no,
but
not,
I mean,
all, not all
there's
men.
There's so few women music journalists as well,
yes,
and culture
especially
journalists,
in like,
so
yeah.
It's difficult.
And especially in, like, kind of alternative music and, like, the bloggy culture we came up in, it's not... But then you can say that about anything that's to do with any kind of... alternative music culture, there's not a lot of space for female voices anyway. So most of the time we were coming up, people that we were playing with or the people we were getting interviewed by were dudes. And I don't have, like, I don't know, I think that's what's interesting. Like, definitely after the first record came out, it was annoying to me the narrative was like, well, why do you feel like that about men? Why do you dislike men? I'm like, I don't. I'm in a band with two men.
Yeah, you're in a band with two lovely men.
There are
yeah.
men everywhere in my life. Like, it's not about that, but then I think that that's a problem. Like, I noticed the other day, I wore a t-shirt at a show, which feels like, girls can do anything. And it was because we were playing in Glasgow, and we work with Glasgow Rock School, and I thought that that'd
Amazing.
Be a nice thing to do. But I did notice on the internet afterwards, there's this kind of strange... defensiveness of some male fans of the band. I'm like, no, just because the t-shirt says that, it's meant to encourage and, you know,
what
support.
I mean,
it's not saying
yeah.
men can't. Like, I don't understand this
well,
kind of knee-jerk
huge,
response.
Well, like, everything happening, everybody's on the defense with everything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Me Too era, you're going to get asked that as a woman constantly, whether or not you're famous. Every woman has that responsibility. And to be honest, every man has to deal with that as well now. I can imagine, Martin, you and Ian, I'm sure you both are like having to also question how you behave, or at least just not, I don't know. It's just, it's very much in the forefront right now.
I guess my experience has only ever been being in bands with men, not by choice, but just because I didn't know any other women really that were playing instruments. And you guys have only ever really been in bands with men, again, not by choice, but just because of like who you knew. So I think it's just been a different experience for both of us. So you see it from a different angle than I do, but you've experienced it. Like, even the other day, we did an interview at a festival for like a local radio thing, and this man... at some point, he kind of made a statement and was like, a lot of my friends are excited about this show because they... What was he saying? He's like, they think you're attractive and they, like, heart-eye emoji you. And, that, like, my impulse in that situation was like, Oh, well, that's, we don't really think about it like that.
Yeah.
But then I think it was one of you guys that were like, that's not really a question. What is that?
Good.
And, but then yeah. I think in that, well,
that's just me speaking as like a human
exactly.
being. I don't
it's
think
a human.
It's,
that's what
it's
I'm
a
saying.
Human being
there's
defend,
a line.
Like,
yeah.
As my friend and this and the situation. Mm-hmm. That's, it's simple to me.
That like my impulse in that like moment was just kind of like diffuse it. Mm. And I think that's the irritating thing when people are like, oh, people, you're very aggressive and you're this and that. I'm like, no, because if you, like, it's odd that you've been trained to just diffuse things calmly rather than being like, fuck off, don't ask me that next question. But I don't know. I think it's an interesting time that we are living in. But I think it's kind of weird because we don't really think about gender when we're doing anything, when we're hanging out together or when we're writing songs or when we're making a record or when we're playing a show. Like, I genuinely don't think that gender exists when we're on stage. It's like, it exists when we talk about the band. As soon as we announce that a record is coming out or a single is coming out, then we're back on the gender discussion. And I think, you know, I understand that we made a point about that, but at the same time, the questions were always gendered anyway, so you're going to have the conversation one way or another. You just get to decide if you're in the driver's seat or you're in the trunk.
And I think you have every right, as you said, Martin, about having, like, it's you're a human being. I think you have every right to literally say, that's not a question, next one. You're not being rude. Because the truth is that as a journalist, I will speak for us. Obviously, people give everybody a bad reputation, but there is a responsibility that you have to treat people like humans.
And I think I've kind of come to terms with the fact that, like, that's always going to be a part of the part of discussion. But there is a part of me that feels bad for these guys, because a lot of the time it feels like the conversation about the band is derailed by that, because that's all that people can talk about.
Yeah.
Not all they can talk about. But
I think it's fair to say it's about 85% of what people talk about.
See,
when it comes
with churches.
Yeah.
Don't
but
you think that's
well, but
it's
like,
so
what
frustrating?
Can you do about
that's
it, really?
Why I
you
wanted
know?
You all on this podcast. I feel like live there is this energy with the three of you that you cannot. It's very difficult to get, especially the type of music you make. And there's pacing. And your pacing is great in your songwriting, and especially how you all perform. I feel like that is really, really interesting. To know that process behind it.
Well, that's nice of you to say, but I think it's important for me to point out that really it doesn't matter to me what people say outside of the band in any way.
Okay.
I know the level of contribution that I've had to the project. I know what Ian does.
You
know
what
Lauren
do.
Does, and that's fine. And that's fine. It's really flattering to for you to say that, though. It's nice of you.
Plus, I feel like that's the stuff that will hopefully last. You know what I mean? That's the stuff that actually matters after the fact, when a media trend has passed or when people have moved on with their Neanderthal caveman brains, you know? Like,
yeah.
And I guess, I don't know, I feel like it's always going to be part of any conversation I have in any work I ever do, but these guys, I do feel frustrated on their behalf sometimes because, you know, it's just like you've just inherited this in some ways and it's kind of shit. But, you know, I kind of feel like it's just about weathering the storm. If you know what I mean.
And your, as I said, live, your music can transcend that. You know, it sounds very big to say, but I was like covering this weird thing with Jane. Do you know Jane Birkin and Charlotte Gainsbourg? You know, Serge Gainsbourg.
Yes, yes, yes.
So they did the press conference before Primavera like a month ago, and the first question they were asked was, what do you think of the Me Too movement? And both of them put their mics down and walked out. Because they were like, this is not about my music. I just want to talk about my art. And so in that case, to be honest, it is okay to feel something about it, but I quite like that you say that you know exactly what you do, which I feel like by them walking out, they also kind of were like, we know what we do. We don't need this, you know? So I really like that you said that. I think that that's so important to...
Plus, nobody's now at shows talking about this, you know? I think that's like, this is more in the abstract conversation around the band. Like, I feel like when we're writing and when we're playing shows, people aren't standing in the crowds thinking about the politics that surround the band or the social issues or anything like that. Like, they're there because the music is connected with them and they want to be a part of that. And I think that that's what's nice for us, is to just focus on that bit.
Well, I don't think we're a successful band because of the politics of our band, you know? I don't think it's about
the
that.
Music.
I think it's about something completely different.
Yeah.
What it should be about. And it's absolutely important to address this stuff because, A, it's happening firsthand to our friend and bandmate. But at the same time, I don't think this is why we're where we are. I really don't believe that.
Why do you think you are still playing together?
because it's fun and I like to write music and I'm good at it, and
pay
so are
rent.
These two.
I need
to pay my rent. Yeah, well, no, well, yeah.
No. Do you, especially with the new album and mixing it with your discography and everything that you've written, do you find it's tricky sometimes to know what to space between certain songs? Because obviously you have to play the hits. People are going to want to play it, you know, people are going to want to hear them. So how do you mush those three worlds together?
It's easy. It's just like curating. At festivals, it's different. You have to like make particular decisions to keep the energy levels up, because people like to have energetic concerts at festivals, usually because they're more drunk or on whatever else.
Or at 2:45 in the
morning. Yeah, 2:45, I think there'll be a lot of people on a lot of really shit cocaine. But that's okay. They can do them. At a headliner, it's different.
Mm.
I think at a headliner, it's more... You get a chance to... A, your album's had a minute to breathe, so you can play some of the weirder stuff off of that. And and that you can maybe even go searching through some of the stuff that you think that a hardcore fan might enjoy, that maybe a, because there's 3,000 people at the show and not 40 or whatever, you know, that's, you can go a little deeper into your back catalogue and have a bit more fun curating the gig. That's cool.
Yeah, it's just a discussion that we all have, and if somebody has an idea of like working up something that we haven't already worked on, you know, we'll discuss it and figure out how to make it happen.
Do you find that process fun? Like, I know it's, I know I'm trying to, like, I'm quite enthusiastic about that, because especially I like that you said that there is a difference between playing a little show versus a festival. I think people don't realize that you actually have to be cognizant of that fan at certain times of the day. You know, if you're playing in the afternoon, which I don't think you have, you played in the afternoon recently?
Yeah, so we play in the daylight a lot. I don't know if we changed the set around so much
times of the
for
day.
For that reason.
Okay.
But there's definitely stuff that we have that works better, like in a tent or at night, or like, for example, at 2 a.m. or whatever, you're going to lean on the more energetic electronic side of your band than you would if you were playing in like McCarran Park at 2 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon. You're going to bring a different energy that time, you know?
And both, you feel serviced by both? You feel like this is... You feel
They're all both fun in a different way. Like there's, you can, it can derive a lot of pleasure from playing an afternoon set where people are like, you can see them all sitting on the hill or whatever, and they're kind of having, eating lunch or whatever and having a nice time. It's been a long time since we did like one of those properly, but those are also fun.
But seeing as though you've all been to so many different places, do you have the, a favorite show that you've played? Or actually, you know what? Let's, can we start at the first show? Because I don't even know where was the first show that you all played together.
It was 6 years ago, last week. Is that right?
Oh, no way!
Well, as churches, yeah, we did a couple of like cheeky warm-up shows under a different name in order to kind of like make some mistakes in private, in relative private.
What was the name?
Shark Week was the name of our fantasy alter ego. Which
shout out Dave McGee.
Guys, none of you are laughing.
Concerts.
This is very funny.
We asked our local promoter for like a, who is still our promoter, for like a baptism of fire.
Yeah.
We wanted a gig that there would be nobody at, and then a gig that there would be like a pretty hostile crowd at. And nobody knew it was churches. But you could see them, because we only had one song out at the time, you could kind of see them over those two warm-ups. Being like, oh yeah, like after a while.
We did not play, like, it was when Lies was online. We played that right at the end and then ran away.
Yeah.
How did that go? Do you remember the first one?
I think the first was the first one in Edinburgh. It was in a place called the Electric Circus in Edinburgh. And then after that, we played in the Pavilion in Dunfermline, supporting a band called The Draymen. And I will say, The Draymen and us don't necessarily have a huge crossover fan base from what I can tell.
Yeah.
In a similar way to Martin's discussion of his Radiohead show experience, I was like, I feel like there's elements of... I was like, oh no, this may not go well for me. It was fine. They were really... I think I saw some... I feel like it was kicking off when it was time for us to go. I was like, they're going to have a big night in here.
Yeah.
Well, there, once that's at the top sort of, after we played.
A lot of white.
I met a lot of small, like, pasty-looking... guys from Scotland with their tops off, their bellies out.
Yep, a lot of cider, getting drunk in the car park, stuff like that.
I mean, I love that you can elicit that from your fans.
Well, this is what we asked for. Asked for a baptism of fire, you know. He could have put us on a bill with, like, some nice indie bands that would have really enjoyed it or whatever, but that's not what we wanted, because the first actual gig was really an unusual experience from anything I'd experienced in my life, because there was one song out and suddenly all this attention, and that...
That was when your EP... Was that 2013?
Before, yeah, it was. We put a song on Neon Gold... And suddenly, like, every A&R, and this sounds like a dickhead thing to say, but whatever, all the A&Rs in London
came to
Glasgow, and our first ever show was sold out because of people and the buzz around the city or whatever about this new band. And the last thing we wanted to do was for it to literally be the first time we had taken the stage together, was to be in front of all half of London and then all of the scenesters in Glasgow. That, I'll tell you what, they'd end your career quicker than A&R guys.
Yeah, I'm sure. And,
So that was technically the third gig, and it was fine. The only thing I really remember was...
Wait, did you know that the A&Rs were going to be there?
Yeah.
What? Did you freak out? Or you, maybe you were totally shitting. Yeah, I was like, you guys will look pretty cool and chilled right now. Well, I would freak out.
Well, I don't. I remember. I think it's the only show I've ever done that tequila shot before. Like our manager Campbell, who's also from Scotland, got 4 tequila shots, and we all did one before we went. And I think that was the first, not even a disagreement, but I think Campbell was like talking about how the venue is quite small, it's quite flat, and I'm quite small. And he was like, no one's going to be able to see you. You might have to stand in a box. And then we went to and fro on this box for like 15 minutes until I was like, I'm not going to stand in a box. I feel so stupid. I'm not doing it. And then he was like, oh, okay. Like, he was just trying to, like, you know, make people get their money for, you know, so they could see the person who was singing. But I'm kind of glad I didn't stand in the box. I think that would have just...
No.
I don't remember that argument. It must have been a quiet argument between you and Campbell. That's funny. I mean, I remember the box, but I remember that there was no box. But I don't remember what happened in between, so that
figures. Now you know what happened to the box.
Like, a bar charge came back with, like, a couple of options for the box, and I was like, I'm not going to stand in an upturned beer crate or a bucket. Like, I can't do this. I don't know. So I think we need to concentrate enough. Yeah. I'm going to fall off this box and then fall on my ass, and I'll just look stupid. So... But, you know, ironically, later, like, on the last album, we got, like, little boxes.
Weren't you guys on boxes?
No, I believe you actually asked for 2 boxes so you could stand up.
They're, like, little mini risers, you know. And if you... And, like, you know, I think it's fun to use them as part of the staging of the show, but it's if it's, like, you have to stand in the middle only on your wee box, so it's like, oh, I can't.
So what you're saying is if he had offered you a mini riser, you would have said yes?
Not in that moment, no. But, you know, got to read the room. Got to know yourself. In that moment, I was like, do I want to stand on this upturned creative hanging?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Guys, you could just do one of those human pyramid things that you were talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, that's what...
Yeah, I think I was just like, I don't really feel that confident doing this anyway, and I'm going to look like a tool if I'm standing on top of a beer crate.
No, come on. That would have been ridiculous.
You know, the ones that we eventually got for the last album tour, so I was like, these are actual, like, these aren't beer crates, you know what I mean? And I think in that moment, I was like, oh, gosh, it's just
kind of like... I love how you have a particular type of box that you like. This is great.
You know, I was like, it doesn't... I think I was stressed about the impression that, you know, we didn't really know what impression people were going to get. And you can't control what people think, but we were so early days. I was like, I don't think the impression I want people to get of it is, like, this tiny, diminutive little lassie that has to stand on a box because nobody can see
you. You definitely don't feel tiny on that stage, I can tell you. I mean, you move
around.
Boxes, that's true.
It's an illusion.
Yeah,
we only employ height appropriate people as well. We're all really just hobbits at the end of the day. But the drummer that we got, ideal. He's like 5'8".
Oh, really? Right,
brilliant.
But again, so powerful. And I think, I don't know, I feel like I want playing shows to be about, like, your playing ability and, like, so much of the stuff. I think it's so interesting that so much of it's about body language. Like, as soon as I started changing my body language, people started feeling differently about the shows.
How did you change your body language? In what way?
I saw a TED talk by a lady called Amy Cuddy, and she's like a psychologist, I think, and she was talking about how, like, your body language influences your mental state and vice versa. So if you feel depressed or uncomfortable, then you'll kind of make inward body. Absolutely. I guess we're doing this, but people can't see this.
I know. Like, we have like, to tell them we are both hunched over.
Physically.
We're all hunched over right now.
So yes, you'll feel like physically and emotionally smaller, but if you kind of... I think it's like open body poses and power poses and stuff. So basically everything that... When you look at like rock performers like Dave Grohl or whatever, like when he's doing the wide-legged stance, that's because he's an awesome frontman, but also it's like powerful open body language.
Yeah.
And then that probably tricks your brain. And yeah.
That's so amazing that you actually did that. So I've watched so many TED Talks, and the reason, like, people ask me, why did you do that? I'm like, I watched a journal how to podcast, you know. But I totally, yeah, I really appreciate you even mentioning that. If people are only figuring out who you are now, they're like, oh yeah, of course you've been like this all the, you know, for the whole time. But for the fans that have known you from the beginning, it's such an amazing journey to watch how you have changed. But not in a way of like, oh, you were tiny, now you're big. In a way of like, everything is so different.
Well, yeah, and I think it's important for to develop at its own pace. And we need to figure out what we want it to be. And I would rather have it be... I think it should change and evolve over the course of time with every album. But I think if we'd been forcing something and faking something from the start, then it would have ended up being something very different.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again. I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.